Cash promised to give Smith one of his guitars if he could supply him with detailed information about and photographs of Wounded Knee. The St. Francis concert gave Cash an excuse to finally see Wounded Knee. He listened attentively as Jesse White Lance, Robert Holydance, and William Horn Cloud, descendants of those killed, took him around the site and showed him the grave markers. He was particularly taken with the story of the Indian leader known as Bigfoot. "I took John and June back in my car after the visit," says Smith. "As we drove through the Badlands, June fell asleep. When we got to the airport, she woke up and John said, 'I think I've got something you ought to hear.' And he just sang this song called Bigfoot to both of us, keeping track of the melody by slapping his leg." Some of the most revealing footage Elvstrom shot on tour was of Cash backstage before and after concerts. At 36, Cash looked like a man in his prime. The gaunt and skinny look of his amphetamine days had been replaced by a full, solid face, powerful shoulders, and a slow, swaggering walk. It was as though this was the look he had always been meant to grow into, and he seemed far more handsome in his early middle age than he had as a teenager or a young man. He still twitched and scratched his neck, but now with the natural energy of a man getting ready to meet his audience, rather than the edginess of an addict. "Before he went on stage, he was rolling everything through his head," says Elvstrom. "He was clearing his voice and psyching himself up. He was intense. He also displayed a commendable courteousness to those who found their way backstage, either to share their songs with him or to ask him to sing for them. In one clip, a singer called Buzz Martin comes by with a tape of his songs, and Cash gives him his guitar and asks him to play the best song you've got that you think I might record. Martin responds by playing a song about his wife, who he has nicknamed Biscuit, and Cash, after laughing throughout, commends him on his ability with words. Another young man comes by and asks him to play Great Speckled Bird for his girlfriend, and Cash obliges. In a longer sequence, an 18-year-old Canadian songwriter, Don Freed, plays him two Dylan-esque folk songs that he had written, one of which was called The Banks of Mariposa. Freed traveled from Saskatoon for this opportunity and came equipped with guitar, harmonica, and brass. Cash listens intently and promises to get him an audition with Columbia. Freed looks disbelieving, but Cash assures him that he wouldn't tell him he liked a song if he didn't. While Elvstrom shot this documentary, a film production team employed by the commercial company Granada Television, 3,000 miles away in London, considered the idea of producing an arts program on Cash. Mostly in their late 20s, they were possibly the hippest group of creatives in British television, regarded equally with suspicion and envy for their links to the burgeoning underground scene of avant-garde films, radical politics, fashion, and rock music. Two of them, Jonathan Cott and David Dalton, contributed regularly to Rolling Stone. Jeffrey Cannon was the first rock critic for a British daily newspaper. As a team, they'd recently made a film about the Doors that spliced concert footage with news coverage of napalm falling in Vietnam and anti-war protesters being clubbed by police. They would go on to cover the Rolling Stones' momentous 1969 Hyde Park appearance following the death of guitarist Brian Jones. Their mission, they had decided, was to show that rock music was both a commentary on and a cause of cultural change in the modern world. "It was in this context that I had a bad idea," says Jeffrey Cannon. In those days, people like us thought of country as music for redneck hoedowns, but the journalist in me, that I tried to suppress, could smell a story. So I came into our office one November morning and asked Joe Durden Smith, Jonathan Cott, and David Dalton to join me at the big round table, and I said, "I have a bad idea, but I know it will be a hit. How about getting Johnny Cash to do a second gig at Folsom Prison and filming it?" Cannon had half hoped his friends would nix the idea, but instead they showed mild interest and one found a number for Saul Holliff. Cannon phoned but was told quite firmly that Johnny Cash had no interest in revisiting Folsom Prison. "Having made the dud call, the idea began worming its way into my consciousness," says Cannon. "I began to see that actually this was a good idea. Nothing like a concert where a jailbird sang songs about desperation to no-hopers and lifers in prison had ever been transmitted on national network television, and this was one of our touchstones." So a couple of days later, I rang Holliff a second time. He was still polite and still not interested. Then, just as I was going to say bye, he said, "But Johnny's going to San Quentin. He'd be happy to make a film with you there." San Quentin State Prison was bigger, older, and even more notorious than Folsom. Perched on 432 acres of land in Marin County and overlooking the San Francisco Bay near the San Rafael Bridge, it housed almost 6,000 inmates and had a staff of more than 1,500. As with Folsom, Cash was comfortable with it as a venue because he had played there before, back on New Year's Day in 1959 when future country star Merle Haggard was one of the prisoners in the audience. This time, Columbia was more than interested in capturing the concert for posterity. They asked Granada what sort of percentage they would like in the recording. The film's director, Michael Darlow, suggested to his boss, Cecil Bernstein, that they ask for 4%. Bernstein said, "I don't want that. Nobody's heard of Johnny Cash. Take 800 pounds, remembers Darlow. That was the worst decision Granada ever made. When I told the guy from Columbia that we only wanted 800 pounds, he couldn't get off the phone fast enough. Darlow and producer Joe Durden-Smith flew out to California and met up with Cash before a show in San Diego. One of the first things I did was to ask him if he'd be willing to write a song about San Quentin in the way that he had written one about Folsom," says Darlow. He told Darlow in no uncertain terms exactly what he could do with his idea. "I was crestfallen. June came over to me and whispered in my ear, 'That means he'll do it.' I fell in love with her at once." They went on to San Quentin ahead of the concert, which was scheduled for February 24, 1969, to film the prison and interview inmates. "It was full of chaos, the whole thing," says Darlow. "I went to see the prison governor and he wanted to know what was in it for them. I did a deal where he got a cabinet radiogram and the prison got a sound system. Then 12 hard guys came and told us that we needed protection, and the senior guard advised us to accept their offer. So these guys looked after us, and they became the 12 guys in the front row at the concert." Darlow and Durden-Smith wanted to make a documentary that, like the Doors film, interspersed social realism with art to underline the connection. They interviewed men on death row and were impressed with the stories told by the prisoners. Durden-Smith became so engrossed in some of their situations that years later he returned to write a book about one of its inmates, Who Killed George Jackson? There was enormous tension in the prison between blacks and Chicanos, and it got quite difficult, says Durden-Smith. In a sense, the eventual film got transmuted and slightly bent off course. I think we had started off with a notion that San Quentin was somehow a place where tales of regret and love and death and murder come home to roost. The truth is, it wasn't exactly a country and western prison, so the music and the prison don't mix exactly. It was a bit of a mismatch, but nevertheless, not a bad film. Bob Johnston remembers that the tension at San Quentin surpassed that at Folsom. "All the guards were nervous," he says. "They thought that there was going to be a riot." He, Cash, said that when he was singing Folsom Prison Blues and the men were up on the tables yelling, when they were only supposed to clap sitting down, he realized that all he had to say was, "Let's go," and there would have been a full-scale riot. He told me after, "I was tempted. I mean, if there was ever a three-word sentence pregnant with meaning, it was that one." People got carried away. Ralph Gleason, who reviewed the concert for Rolling Stone, observed, "What he did was right on the edge. If he had screwed up one notch higher, the joint would have exploded. He knew when to stop."